She won't see it, her.
Why won't she? Nori asked, eyes wide, aware that the question might be rude, only after it was out and she saw her grandpa frown.
Because she's one stubborn honey. I told her she might get hurt.
Like to see him try, she said. That's my Misha.
Well, hell. If I get a chance later on, I may sneak down and see if she'd change her mind. They say it's a woman's prerogative. Come on, and let's put in a few more of those boxes. And don't cover up the guns, Ernie. We might need them.
I can't believe I got you into this, kiddo, Ernie said.
It's okay, Grandpa. I'd rather be in than out.
And this much, at least, was true. 9. Bonk. Silence. Bonk. Silence. Bonk. Silence. Ollie Dinsmore sat cross-legged 4 feet from the dome with his old Boy Scout pack beside him. The pack was full of rocks he'd picked up in the dooryard. So full, in fact, that he'd staggered down here rather than walked, thinking that the canvas bottom would tear out of the pack and spill his ammo. But it hadn't, and here he was. He selected another rock, a nice smooth one, polished by some ancient glacier, and threw it overhand at the dome. Where it struck would appear to be thin air and bounce back. He picked it up and threw it again. Bonk. Silence. The dome had one thing going for it, he thought. It might be the reason his brother and his mother were dead, but by the hairy old Jesus, one load of ammunition was enough to last all day. Rock boomerangs, he thought, and smiled. It was a real smile, but it made him look somehow terrible because his face was far too thin. He hadn't been eating much, and he thought it would be a good long while before he felt like eating again. Hearing a shot and then finding your mother lying beside the kitchen table with her dress flipped up to show her underpants and half her head blown off, a thing like that did nothing for a fellow's appetite. Bonk. Silence. The other side of the dome was a hive of activity. A tent city had sprung up. Jeeps and trucks scooted to and fro, and hundreds of military guys went buzzing around, while their superiors shouted orders and cussed them out, often in the same breath. In addition to the tents that had already been erected, 3 long new ones were being put up. The signs already planted in front of them read Visitors Hospitality Station 1, Visitors Hospitality Station 2, and First Aid Station. Another tent, even longer, had a sign in front of it reading Light Refreshments. And shortly after Ollie sat down and began tossing his trove of rocks at the dome, 2 flatbed trucks loaded with porta-potties had arrived. Now ranks of cheery-looking blue shithouses stood over there, well away from the area where relatives would stand to speak with loved ones they could look at but not touch. The stuff that had come out of his mother's head had looked like moldy strawberry jam, and what Ollie couldn't understand was why she'd done it that way and in that place. Why in the room where they ate most of their meals? Had she been so far gone that she hadn't realized she had another son, who might eat again, assuming he didn't starve to death first, but who would never forget the horror of what lay there on the floor? Yep, he thought. That far gone. Because Rory was always her favorite, her pet. She hardly knew I was around. Unless I forgot to feed the cows or swab out the stalls when they were afield. Or if I brought home a D on my rank card. Because he never got anything but A's. He threw a rock. Bonk. Silence. There were several army guys putting up pairs of signs over there near the dome. The ones facing in toward the mill read, Warning. For your own safety, keep 2 yards, 6 feet, from the dome. Ollie guessed the signs pointing the other way said the same, and on the other side they might work because on the other side there would be lots of guys to keep order. Over here, though, there were going to be maybe 800 townies and maybe 2 dozen cops, most of them new to the job. Keeping people back on this side would be like trying to protect a sandcastle from the incoming tide. Her underpants had been wet, and there had been a puddle between her splayed legs. She'd pissed herself either right before she pulled the trigger or right after. Ollie thought probably after. He threw a rock. Bonk. Silence. There was one army guy close by. He was pretty young. There wasn't any kind of insignia on his sleeve, so Ollie guessed he was probably a private. He looked about 16. But Ollie supposed he had to be older. He'd heard of kids lying about their age to get into the service, but he guessed that was before everybody had computers to keep track of such things. The army guy looked around, saw no one was paying him any attention, and spoke in a low voice. He had a southern accent.
Kid, would y'all stop doing that? It's driving me bug shit.
Go someplace else then, Ollie said.
Bonk.
Silence.
Kane, orders.
Ollie didn't reply. He threw another rock instead.
Bonk.
Silence.
Why y'all doing it?
The army guy asked. He was now just fiddling with the pair of signs he was putting up so he could talk to Ollie.
Because sooner or later one of them won't bounce back. And when that happens, I'm going to get up and walk away and never see this farm again. Never milk another cow. What's the air like out there?
Good. Chilly, though. I'm from South Carolina. It ain't like this in South Carolina in October, I can tell you that.
Where Ollie was, less than 3 yards from the southern boy, it was hot. Also stinky. The army guy pointed beyond Ollie.
Why don't y'all quit on the rocks and do something about those cows?
He said it, cows.
Herd them into the barn and milk them or rub soothing shit in their udders, something like that.
We don't need to herd them. They know where to go.
Only now they don't need to be milked, and they don't need any bag balm either. Their udders are dry.
Yeah?
Yeah. My dad says something's wrong with the grass. He says the grass is wrong because the air's wrong. It doesn't smell good in here, you know. It smells like crap.
Yeah?
The army guy looked fascinated. He gave the tops of the back-to-back signs a tap or two with his hammer, although they already looked well-seated.
Yeah.
My mother killed herself this morning. The army guy had raised his hammer for another hit. Now he just dropped it to his side.
Are you shitting me, kid?
No, she shot herself at the kitchen table. I found her.
Oh, fuck, that's rough.
The army guy approached the dome.
We took my brother to town when he died last Sunday because he was still alive, a little. But my mom was dead can be, so we buried her on the knoll. My dad and me. She liked it there. It was pretty there before everything got so cruddy.
Jesus, kid, you've been through hell.
Still there, Ollie said,
and as if the words had turned a valve somewhere inside, he began to weep. He got up and went to the dome. He and the young soldier faced each other less than a foot apart. The soldier raised his hand, wincing a little as the transient shock whipped through him and then out of him. He laid his hand on the dome, fingers spread. Ollie lifted his own and pressed it against the dome on his side. Their hands seemed to be touching, finger to finger and palm to palm, but they weren't. It was a futile gesture that would be repeated over and over the following day, hundreds of times, thousands.
Kid.
Private Ames, someone bawled. Get your sorry ass away from there.
Private Ames jumped like a kid who's been caught stealing jam.
Get over here, double time.
Hang in there, kid,
Private Ames said, and ran off to get his scolding. Ollie imagined it had to be a scolding since you couldn't very well demote a private. Surely they wouldn't put him in the stockade or whatever for talking to one of the animals in the zoo. I didn't even get any peanuts, Ollie thought. For a moment he looked up at the cows that no longer gave milk, that hardly even cropped grass, and then he sat down by his pack. He searched for and found another nice round rock. He thought about the chipped polish on the nails of his dead mother's outstretched hand, the one with the still-smoking gun beside it. Then he threw the rock. It hit the dome and bounced back.
Bonk.
Silence. 10. At 4 o'clock on that Thursday afternoon, while the overcast held over northern New England, and the sun shone down on Chester's Mill like a bleary spotlight through the sock-shaped hole in the clouds, Ginny Tomlinson went to check on Junior. She asked if he needed something for headache. He said no. Then changed his mind and asked for some Tylenol or Advil. When she came back, he walked across the room to get it. On his chart, she wrote, limp is still present but seems improved. When Thurston Marshall poked his head in 45 minutes later, the room was empty. He assumed Junior had gone down to the lounge, but when he checked there, it was empty, except for Emily Whitehouse, the heart attack patient. Emily was recovering nicely. Thurst asked her if she'd seen a young man with dark blonde hair and a limp. She said no. Thirst went back to Junior's room and looked in the closet. It was empty. The young man with the probable brain tumor had dressed and checked himself out without benefit of paperwork. 11. Junior walked home. His limp seemed to clear up entirely once his muscles were warm. In addition, the dark keyhole shape floating on the left side of his vision had shrunk to a ball the size of a marble. Maybe he hadn't gotten a full dose of thallium after all. Hard to tell. Either way, he had to keep his promise to God. If he took care of the Appleton kids, then God would take care of him. As he left the hospital, by the back door, killing his father had been first on his to-do list. But by the time he actually got to the house where his mother had died, the house where Lester Coggins and Brenda Perkins had died, he had changed his mind. If he killed his father now, the special town meeting would be canceled. Junior didn't want that, because the town meeting would provide good cover for his main errand. Most of the cops would be there, and that would make gaining access to the coop easier. He only wished he had the poison dog tags. He'd enjoy stuffing them down Barbie's dying throat. Big Jim wasn't at home anyway. The only living thing in the house was the wolf he'd seen loping across the hospital parking lot in the small hours of the morning. It was halfway down the stairs, looking at him and growling deep in its chest. Its fur was ragged, its eyes were yellow. Around its neck hung Dale Barbara's dog tags. Junior closed his eyes and counted to 10. When he opened them, the wolf was gone.
"I'm the wolf now,"
he whispered to the hot and empty house.
"I'm the werewolf. And I saw Lon Chaney dancing with the queen."
He went upstairs, limping again but not noticing. His uniform was in the closet and so was his gun, a Beretta 92 Taurus. The PD had a dozen of them, mostly paid for with federal Homeland Security money. He checked the Beretta's 15-round mag and saw it was full. He put the gun into its holster, cinched the belt around his shrinking waist, and left his room. At the top of the stairs he paused, wondering where to go until the meeting was well underway and he could make his move. He didn't want to talk to anyone, didn't even want to be seen. Then it came to him, a good hiding place that was also close to the action. He descended the stairs carefully. The goddamn limp was all the way back, plus the left side of his face was so numb it might have been frozen, and lurched down the hall. He stopped briefly outside his father's study, wondering if he should open the safe and burn the money inside. He decided it wasn't worth the effort. He vaguely remembered a joke about bankers marooned on a desert island who'd gotten rich trading each other their clothes, and he uttered a brief yapping laugh, even though he couldn't exactly recall the punchline, and had never completely gotten the joke anyway. The sun had gone down behind the clouds to the west of the dome, and the day had grown gloomy. Junior walked out of the house and disappeared into the murk. 12. At 5:15, Alice and Aiden Appleton came in from the backyard of their borrowed house. Alice said,
"Carol, will you take Aiden and me, to the big meeting?"
Carolyn Sturgis, who had been making PB&J sandwiches for supper on Coralie Dumigen's counter with Coralie Dumigen's bread, stale but edible, looked at the children with surprise. She had never heard of kids wanting to attend an adults meeting before, would have said if asked that they'd probably run the other way to avoid such a boring event. She was tempted, because if the kids went, she could go.
"Are you sure?"
she asked, bending down.
"Both of you."
Before these last few days, Carolyn would have said she had no interest in having children, that what she wanted was a career as a teacher and a writer, maybe a novelist, although it seemed to her that writing novels was pretty risky. What if you spent all that time, wrote a 1,000-pager, and it sucked? Poetry, though. Going around the country, maybe on a motorcycle? Doing readings and teaching seminars, free as a bird? That'd be cool. Maybe meeting a few interesting men, drinking wine, and discussing Sylvia Plath in bed. Alice and Aiden had changed her mind. She had fallen in love with them. She wanted the dome to break, of course she did, but giving these two back to their mom was going to hurt her heart. She sort of hoped it would hurt theirs a little, too. Probably that was mean, but there it was.
"Aid? Is it what you want? Because grown-up meetings can be awfully long and boring." "I want to go," Aiden said. "I want to see all the people."
Then Carolyn understood.
It wasn't the discussion of resources and how the town was going to use them as it went forward that interested them. Why would it be? Alice was 9 and Aiden was 5. But wanting to see everybody gathered together like a great big extended family, that made sense. Can you be good, not squirm and whisper too much?
Of course, Alice said with dignity.
And will you both pee yourselves dry before we go?
Yes.
This time the girl rolled her eyes to show what an annoying stupidnik Carol was being. And Carol sort of loved it.
Then what I'll do is just pack these sandwiches to go, Carolyn said. And we've got 2 cans of soda for kids who can be good and use straws. Assuming the kids in question have peed themselves dry before dumping any more liquid down their throats, that is.
I use straws like mad, Aiden said. Any whoops?
He means whoopie pies, Alice said.
I know what he means, but there aren't any. I think there might be some graham crackers, though. The kind with cinnamon sugar on them.
Cinnamon graham crackers rock, Aiden said. I love you, Carol.
Carolyn smiled. She thought no poem she'd ever read had been so beautiful. Not even the Williams one, about the cold plums. 13. Andrea Grinnell descended the stairs slowly but steadily while Julia stared in amazement. Andy had undergone a transformation. Makeup and a comb out of the frizzy wreck that had been her hair had played a part, but that wasn't all of it. Looking at her, Julia realized how long it had been since she'd seen the town's 3rd selectman looking like herself. This evening she was wearing a knockout red dress belted at the waist. It looked like Ann Taylor. And carrying a large fabric bag with a drawstring top. Even Horace was gawking.
How do I look? Andy asked when she reached the bottom of the stairs. Like I could fly to the town meeting if I had a broom?
You look great. 20 years younger.
Thanks, hon, but I have a mirror upstairs.
If it didn't show you how much better you look, you better try one down here where the light's better. Andy switched her bag to her other arm as if it were heavy.
Well, I guess I do. A little, anyway.
Are you sure you have strength enough for this?
I think so, but if I start to shake and shiver, I'll slip out the side door.
Andy had no intention of slipping away, whether she shook or not.
What's in the bag?
Jim Rennie's lunch, Andrea thought, which I intend to feed him in front of this whole town.
I always take my knitting to town meeting. Sometimes they're just so slow and dull.
I don't think this one will be dull, Julia said.
You're coming, aren't you?
Oh, I imagine, Julia said vaguely. She expected to be well away from downtown Chester's Mill before the meeting ended.
I have a few things to do first.
Can you get there on your own? Andy gave her a comical mother please look.
Down the street, down the hill, and it's right there. Been doing it for years.
Julia looked at her watch. It was 5:45.
Aren't you leaving awfully early? Al will open the doors at 6:00, if I'm not mistaken, and I want to be sure and get a good seat.
As a select woman, you should be right up there on stage, Julia said. If it's what you want.
No, I don't think so.
Andy switched the bag to her other arm again. Her knitting was inside. So was the Vader file and the .38 her brother Twitch had given her for home protection. She thought it would serve just as well for town protection. A town was like a body, but it had one advantage over the human one. If a town had a bad brain, a transplant could be affected. And maybe it wouldn't come to killing. She prayed it wouldn't. Julia was looking at her quizzically. Andrea realized she'd drifted off.
I think I'll just sit with the common folk tonight. But I'll have my say when the time comes.
You can count on that. 14. Andy was right about Al Timmons opening the doors at 6. By then, Main Street, next to Empty All Day, was filling with citizens headed for the town hall. More walked in little groups downtown Common Hill from the residential streets. Cars began to arrive from East Chester and North Chester, most filled to capacity. No one, it seemed, wanted to be alone tonight. She was early enough to have her pick of seats, and chose the 3rd row from the stage on the aisle. Just ahead of her in the 2nd row were Carolyn Sturges and the Appleton children. The kids were gawking wide-eyed at everything and everyone. The little boy had what appeared to be a graham cracker clutched in his fist. Linda Everett was another early arriver. Julia had told Andy about Rusty being arrested, utterly ridiculous, and knew his wife must be devastated, but she was hiding it well, behind great makeup and a pretty dress with big patch pockets. Given her own situation, mouth dry, head aching, stomach roiling, Andy admired her courage. "Come sit with me, Linda," she said, patting the spot beside her. "How is Rusty?" "I don't know," Linda said, slipping past Andrea and sitting down. Something in one of those amusing pockets clunked on the wood. "They won't let me see him." "That situation will be rectified," Andrea said. "Yes," Linda said grimly. "It will." Then she leaned forward. "Hello, kids. What are your names?" "This is Aiden," Caro said, "and this is..."
"I'm Alice."
The little girl held out a regal hand, queen to loyal subject.
"Me and Aiden and I, are Dorphins. That means dome orphans. Thurston made it up. He knows magic tricks like pulling a quarter out of your ear and stuff."
"Well, you seem to have landed on your feet," Linda said, smiling. She didn't feel like smiling. She had never been so nervous in her life. Only nervous was too mild a word. She was scared shitless. 15. By 6:30, the parking lot behind the town hall was full. After that, the spaces on Main Street went, and those on West Street and East Street. By 6:45, even the post office and FD parking lots were loaded, and almost every seat in the town hall was taken. Big Jim had foreseen the possibility of an overflow, and Al Timmons, assisted by some of the newer cops, had put benches from the American Legion Hall on the lawn. "Support our troops," was printed on some. "Play more bingo," on others. Large Yamaha speakers had been placed on either side of the front door. Most of the town's police force, and all of the veteran cops save one, were present to keep order. When latecomers grumbled about having to sit outside, or stand, when even the benches had filled up, Chief Randolph told them they should have come earlier. If you snooze, you lose. Also, he added, it was a pleasant night, nice and warm, and later there was apt to be another big pink moon.
"Pleasant, if you don't mind the smell," Joe Boxer said.
The dentist had been in an unrelievedly crappy mood ever since the confrontation at the hospital over his liberated waffles.
"I hope we can hear all right through those things."
He pointed at the speakers.
"You'll hear fine," Chief Randolph said. "We got them from Dippers. Tommy Anderson says they're state-of-the-art, and he set them up himself. Think of it as a drive-in movie without the picture." "I think of it as a pain in my ass," Joe Boxer said, then crossed his legs and plucked fussily at the crease on his pants.
Junior watched them come from his hiding place inside the Peace Bridge, peeking through a crack in the wall. He was amazed to see so much of the town in the same place at the same time, and gratified by the speakers. He would be able to hear everything from where he was. And once his father got really cranked up, he would make his move. "God help anyone who gets in my way," he thought. His father's slope-bellied bulk was impossible to miss, even in the growing gloom. Also, the town hall was fully powered this evening, and light from one of the windows drew an oblong down to where Big Jim stood on the edge of the jam parking lot. Carter Thibodeau was at his side. Big Jim had no sense of being watched. Or rather, he had a sense of being watched by everybody, which comes to the same. He checked his watch and saw it had just gone 7. His political sense, honed over many years, told him that an important meeting should always begin 10 minutes late, no more and no less, which meant this was the time to start down the taxiway. He was holding a folder with his speech inside it, but once he got going, he wouldn't need it. He knew what he was going to say. It seemed to him that he had given the speech in his sleep last night, not once but several times, and each time it had been better. He nudged Carter. "Time to put this show on the road."
"Okay."
Carter ran over to where Randolph was standing on the town hall steps. "Probably thinks he looks like Julius Cotton Pickin' Caesar," Big Jim thought, and brought the chief back.
"We go in the side door," Big Jim said.
He consulted his watch.
4 minutes from now, You'll lead, Peter. I'll go second. Carter, you come behind me. We'll go straight to the stage, all right? Walk confidently, no gosh darn slouching. There'll be applause. Stand at attention until it starts to taper off. Then sit. Peter, you'll be on my left. Carter, on my right. I'll step forward to the podium. Prayer first. Then everybody stands to sing the national anthem. After that, I'll speak and run the agenda just as fast as poop through a goose. They'll vote yay on everything. Got it?
I'm nervous as a witch, Randolph confessed.
Don't be. This is going to be fine. He was certainly wrong about that.
16. While Big Jim and his entourage were walking toward the side door of the town hall, Rose was turning the restaurant van into the McClatchy driveway. Following her was a plain Chevrolet sedan driven by Joni Calvert. Claire came out of the house holding a suitcase in one hand and a canvas carry bag filled with groceries in the other. Joe and Benny Drake also had suitcases, although most of the clothes in Benny's had come from Joe's dresser drawers. Benny was carrying another, smaller canvas sack loaded with loot from the McClatchy pantry. From down the hill came the amplified sound of applause.
Hurry up, Rose said. "The starting. Time for us to get out of Dodge."
Lissa Jameson was with her. She slid open the van's door and began handing stuff inside.
"Is there a lead roll to cover the windows?" Joe asked Rose.
"Yes, an extra piece is for Joni's car as well. We'll drive as far as you say it's safe, then block the windows. Give me that suitcase."
"This is insane, you know," Joni Calvert said.
She walked a fairly straight line between her car and the Sweetbriar van, which led Rose to believe she'd had no more than a single drink or two to fortify herself. That was a good thing.
"You're probably right," Rose said. "Are you ready?"
Joni sighed and put her arm around her daughter's slim shoulders.
"For what, going to hell in a handbasket? Why not? How long will we have to stay up there?"
"I don't know," Rose said.
Joni gave another sigh.
"Well, at least it's warm."
Joe asked Nori,
"Where's your gramps?"
"With Jackie and Mr. Burpee in the van we stole from Rennie's. He'll wait outside while they go in to get Rusty and Mr. Barbara."
She gave him a scared-to-death smile.
"He's going to be their wheelman."
"No fool like an old fool," Joni Calvert remarked.
Rose felt like hauling off and hitting her, and a glance at Lissa told her that Lissa felt the same. But this was no time for argument, let alone fisticuffs. Hang together or hang separately, Rose thought.
"What about Julia?"
Claire asked.
"She's coming, with Piper.
And her dog." From downtown, amplified and with the bench sitters outside adding their own voices, came the United Choir of Chester's Mill singing the Star-Spangled Banner.
"Let's go," Rose said. "I'll lead the way."
Joni Calvert repeated with a kind of dolorous good cheer.
"At least it's warm. Come on, Nori, co-pilot your old mom."
17. There was a delivery lane on the south side of Leclerc's Maison des Fleurs, and here the stolen phone company van was parked, nose out. Ernie, Jackie, and Romy Burpee sat listening to the national anthem coming from up the street. Jackie felt a sting behind her eyes and saw that she wasn't the only one who was moved. Ernie, sitting behind the wheel, had produced a handkerchief from his back pocket and was dabbing at his eyes with it.
"Guess we won't need Linda to give us a heads up," Romy said. "I didn't expect them speakers. They didn't get them from me."
"It's still good for people to see her there," Jackie said.
"Got your mask, Romy?" He held up Dick Cheney's visage, stamped in plastic. In spite of his extensive stock, Romy hadn't been able to provide Jackie with an aerial mask. She had settled for Harry Potter's chum, Hermione. Ernie's Darth Vader mask was behind the seat, but Jackie thought they'd probably be in trouble if he actually had to put it on. She had not said this aloud. And really, what does it matter? When we're suddenly not around town anymore, everybody's going to have a good idea why we're gone. But suspecting wasn't the same as knowing, and if suspicion was the best Rennie and Randolph could do, the friends and relatives they were leaving behind might be subjected to no more than harsh questioning. Might. Under circumstances like these, Jackie realized that was a mighty big word. The anthem ended. There was more applause.
and then the town's second selectman began to speak. Jackie checked the pistol she was carrying. It was her extra, and thought that the next few minutes were probably going to be the longest of her life. 18. Barbie and Rusty stood at the doors of their respective cells, listening as Big Jim launched into his speech. Thanks to the speakers outside the main doors of the town hall, they could hear pretty well.
Thank you. Thank you, one and all. Thank you for coming. And thank you for being the bravest, toughest, can-doingest people in these United States of America.
Enthusiastic applause.
Ladies and gentlemen, and kiddies too, I see a few of those in the audience.
Good-natured laughter.
We are in a terrible predicament here, this you know. Tonight I intend to tell you how we got into it. I don't know everything, but I will share what I know because you deserve that. When I finish putting you in the picture, we have a brief but important agenda to go through. But first and foremost, I want to tell you how proud I am of you. How humbled I am to be the man God and you have chosen to be your leader at this critical juncture. And I want to assure you that together we will come through this trial. Together, and with God's help, we will emerge stronger and truer and better than we ever were before. We may be Israelites in the desert now.
Barbie rolled his eyes and Rusty made a jacking-off gesture with his fist.
But soon we will reach Canaan and the feast of milk and honey which the Lord and our fellow Americans will surely set before us.
Wild applause. It sounded like a standing O. Fairly certain that even if there was a bug down here, the three or four cops upstairs would now be clustered in the PD doorway, listening to Big Jim. Barbie said, "Be ready, my friend."
"I am," Rusty said. "Believe me, I am."
Just as long as Linda's not one of them planning to bust in, he thought. He didn't want her killing anyone, but more than that, he didn't want her to risk being killed. Not for him. Let her stay right where she is. He may be crazy, but at least if she's with the rest of the town, she's safe. That was what he thought before the gunfire started.
19. Big Jim was exultant. He had them exactly where he wanted them, in the palm of his hand. Hundreds of people, those who had voted for him and those who hadn't. He had never seen so many in this hall, not even when school prayer or the school budget was under discussion. They sat thigh to thigh and shoulder to shoulder, outside as well as in, and they were doing more than listening to him. With Sanders AWOL and Grinnell sitting in the audience, that red dress in the third row was hard to miss, he owned this crowd. Their eyes begged him to take care of them, to save them. What completed his exultancy was having his bodyguard beside him and seeing the lines of cops, his cops, ranged along both sides of the hall. Not all of them were kitted out in uniforms yet, but all were armed. At least 100 more in the audience were wearing blue armbands. It was like having his own private army.
"My fellow townspeople, most of you know that we have arrested a man named Dale Barbara." A storm of boos and hisses arose.
Big Jim waited for it to subside, outwardly grave, inwardly grinning.
"For the murders of Brenda Perkins, Lester Coggins, and two lovely girls we all knew and loved, Angie McCain and Dodie Sanders."
More boos, interspersed with cries of "Hang him!" and "Terrorist!" The terrorist shouter sounded like Velma Winter, the day manager at Brownie's store.
"What you do not know," Big Jim continued, "is that the dome is the result of a conspiracy perpetrated by an elite group of rogue scientists and covertly funded by a government splinter group. We are guinea pigs in an experiment, my fellow townspeople. And Dale Barbara was the man designated to chart and guide that experiment's course from the inside."
Stunned silence greeted this. Then there was a roar of outrage. When it had quieted, Big Jim continued, hands planted on either side of the podium, his large face shining with sincerity and perhaps hypertension. His speech lay in front of him, but it was still folded,
There was no need to look at it. God was using his vocal cords and moving his tongue.
When I speak of covert funding, you may wonder what I mean. The answer is horrifying, but simple. Dale Barbara, aided by an as-yet-unknown number of townspeople, set up a drug manufacturing facility which has been supplying huge quantities of crystal methamphetamine to drug lords, some with CIA connections, all up and down the eastern seaboard. And although he hasn't given us the names of all his co-conspirators yet, one of them, it breaks my heart to tell you this, appears to be Andy Sanders.
Hubbub and cries of wonder from the audience. Big Jim saw Andy Grinnell start to rise from her seat, then settle back. That's right, he thought. Just sit there. If you're reckless enough to question me, I'll eat you alive. Or point my finger at you and accuse you. Then they'll eat you alive. And in truth, he felt as if he could do that.
Barbara's boss, his control, is a man you have all seen on the news. He claims to be a colonel in the U.S. Army, but in fact, he is high in the councils of the scientists and government officials responsible for this satanic experiment. I have Barbara's confession to this much right here.
He tapped his sport coat, whose inner pocket contained his wallet and a digest-sized New Testament with the words of Christ printed in red. Meanwhile, more cries of hang him had arisen. Big Jim lifted one hand, head lowered, face grave, and the cries eventually stilled.
We will vote on Barbara's punishment as a town, one unified body dedicated to the cause of freedom. It's in your hands, ladies and gentlemen. If you vote to execute, he will be executed. But there will be no hanging while I am your leader. He will be executed by police firing squad.
Wild applause interrupted him, and most of the assembly rose to its feet. Big Jim leaned into the microphone.
But only after we get every bit of information which is still hidden in his miserable traitor's heart.
Now almost all of them were up.
Not Andy, though.
She sat in the third row next to the center aisle, looking up at him with eyes that should have been soft and hazy and confused, but were not.
Look at me all you want, he thought, just as long as you sit there like a good little girl.
Meanwhile, he basked in the applause. 20.
No, Romy asked. What you think, Jackie?
Wait a little longer, she said. It was instinct, nothing else. And usually her instincts were dependable. Later, she would wonder how many lives might have been saved if she had told Romy, okay, let's roll. 21. Looking through his crack in the sidewall of the Peace Bridge, Junior saw that even the people on the benches outside had risen to their feet, and the same instinct that told Jackie to stay a little longer told him it was time to move. He limped from beneath the bridge on the town common side and cut across to the sidewalk. When the creature who had sired him resumed speaking, he started toward the police department. The dark spot on the left side of his field of vision had expanded again, but his mind was clear.
I'm coming, Barbie. I'm coming for you right now.
22.
These people are masters of disinformation, Big Jim continued. And when you go out to the dome to visit with your loved ones, the campaign against me will kick into high gear. Cox and his surrogates will stop at nothing to blacken me. They'll call me a liar and a thief. They may even say I ran their drug operation myself. You did, a clear, carrying voice said.
It was Andrea Grinnell. Every eye fixed upon her as she rose, a human exclamation point in her bright red dress. She looked at Big Jim for a moment with an expression of cool contempt, then turned to face the people who had elected her third select woman when old Billy Kale, Jack Kale's father, had died of a stroke 4 years ago.
You people need to put your fears aside for a moment, she said. When you do, you'll see that the story he's telling is ludicrous. Jim Rennie thinks you can be stampeded like cattle in a thunderstorm. I've lived with you all my life, and I think he's wrong.
Big Jim waited for cries of protest. There were none. Not that the townspeople necessarily believed her. They were just stunned by this sudden turn of events. Alice and Aiden Appleton had turned all the way around and were kneeling on their benches, goggling at the lady in red. Caro was equally stunned.
A secret experiment? What bullshit? Our government has gotten up to some pretty lousy stuff over the last 50 years or so, and I'd be the first to admit it. But holding a whole town prisoner with some sort of force field? Just to see what we'll do? It's idiotic. Only terrified people would believe it. Rennie knows that. So he's been orchestrating the terror.
Big Jim had been momentarily knocked off his stride, but now he found his voice again. And of course, he had the microphone.
Ladies and gentlemen, Andrea Grinnell is a fine woman, but she's not herself tonight. She's as shocked as the rest of us, of course, but in addition, I'm sorry to say that she herself has a serious drug dependency problem as a result of a fall and her consequent use of an extremely addictive drug called...
I haven't had anything stronger than aspirin for days now, Andrea said in a clear, carrying voice. And I have come into possession of papers which show...
Melvin Searles, Big Jim boomed. Will you and several of your fellow officers gently but firmly remove Selectwoman Grinnell from the room and escort her home, or perhaps to the hospital for observation? She's not herself.
There were some approving murmurs, but not the clamor of approbation he'd expected. And Mel Searles had taken only a single step forward when Henry Morrison swept a hand into Mel's chest and sent him back against the wall with an audible thump.
Let's let her finish, Henry said. She's a town official, too, so let her finish.
Mel looked up at Big Jim, but Big Jim was watching Andy, almost hypnotized, as she drew a brown manila envelope from her big bag. He knew what it was the instant he saw it. Brenda Perkins, he thought. Oh, what a bitch. Even dead, her bitchery continues. As Andy held the envelope up, it began to waver back and forth. The shakes were coming back, the fucking shakes. They couldn't have picked a worse time, but she wasn't surprised. In fact, she might have expected it. It was the stress.
The papers in this envelope came to me from Brenda Perkins, she said, and at least her voice was steady. They were compiled by her husband and the state attorney general. Duke Perkins was investigating James Rennie for a laundry list of high crimes and misdemeanors.
Mel looked at his friend Carter for guidance. And Carter was looking back, his gaze bright and sharp and almost amused. He pointed at Andrea, then held the side of his hand against his throat. Shut her up. This time when Mel started forward, Henry Morrison didn't stop him. Like almost everyone else in the room, Henry was gaping at Andrea Grinnell. Marty Arsenal and Freddie Denton joined Mel as he hurried along the front of the stage, bent over like a man running in front of a movie screen. From the other side of the town hall, Todd Wendelstadt and Lauren Connery were also in motion. Wendelstadt's hand was on a sawed-off piece of hickory cane he was carrying as a nightstick. Connery's was on the butt of her gun. Andy saw them coming, but didn't stop.
The proof is in this envelope, and I believe it's proof...
that Brenda Perkins died for, she intended to finish. But at that moment, her shaking, sweat-slicked left hand lost her grip on the drawstring top of her bag. It fell into the aisle, and the barrel of her Home Protection 38 slid from the bag's puckered mouth like a periscope. Clearly, heard by everyone in the now silent hall, Aiden Appleton said,
"Wow, that lady has a gun."
Another instant of thunderstruck silence followed. Then Carter Thibodeau leaped from his seat and ran in front of his boss, screaming,
"Gun! Gun! Gun!"
Aiden slipped into the aisle to investigate more closely.
"No aid!"
Caro shouted, and bent over to grab him just as Mel fired the first shot. It put a hole in the polished wood floor right in front of Carolyn Sturge's nose. Splinters flew up. One struck her just below the right eye, and blood began to pour down her face. She was vaguely aware that everyone was screaming now. She knelt in the aisle, grabbed Aiden by the shoulders, and hiked him between her thighs like a football. He flew back into the row where they'd been sitting, surprised but unhurt. Gun! She's got a gun! Freddie Denton shouted, and swept Mel out of his way. Later, he would swear that the young woman was reaching for it, and that he had only meant to wound her, anyway. 23. Thanks to the speakers, the three people in the stolen van heard the change in the festivities at the town hall. Big Jim's speech and the accompanying applause were interrupted by some woman, who was talking loudly, but standing too far from the mic for them to make out the words. Her voice was drowned in a general uproar punctuated by screams. Then there was a gunshot.
What the hell? Romy said.
More gunshots. Two, perhaps three. And screams.
Doesn't matter, Jackie said. Drive, Ernie, and fast. If we're going to do this, we have to do it now.
24.
No, Linda cried, leaping to her feet. No shooting! There are children! There are children!
The town hall erupted in pandemonium. Maybe for a moment or two they hadn't been cattle, but now they were. The stampede for the front doors was on. The first few got out, then the crowd jammed up. A few souls who had retained a scrap of common sense beat feet down the side and center aisles toward the exit doors which flanked the stage, but they were a minority. Linda reached for Carolyn Sturges, meaning to pull her back to the relative safety of the benches, when Toby Manning, sprinting down the center aisle, ran into her. His knee connected with the back of Linda's head, and she fell forward, dazed.
Caro!
Alice Appleton was screaming from somewhere far away.
Caro! Get up! Caro! Get up! Caro, get up!
Carolyn started getting to her feet, and that was when Freddie Denton shot her squarely between the eyes, killing her instantly. The children began to shriek. Their faces were freckled with her blood. Linda was vaguely aware of being kicked and stepped on. She got to her hands and knees, standing was currently out of the question, and crawled into the aisle opposite the one she'd been sitting in, her hands squelched in more of Carolyn's blood. Alice and Aiden were trying to get to Caro, knowing they might be seriously hurt if they made it into the aisle, and not wanting them to see what had become of the woman she assumed was their mother. Andy reached over the bench just ahead of her to grab them. She had dropped the Vader envelope. Carter Thibodeau had been waiting for this. He was still standing in front of Rennie, shielding him with his body, but he had drawn his gun and laid it over his forearm. Now he squeezed the trigger, and the troublesome woman in the red dress, the one who had caused this ruckus, went flying backward. The town hall was in chaos, but Carter ignored it. He descended the stairs and walked steadily to where the woman in the red dress had fallen. When people came running down the center aisle, he threw them out of his way, first left and then right. The little girl, crying, tried to cling to his leg, and Carter kicked her aside without looking at her. He didn't see the envelope at first. Then he did. It was lying beside one of the Grinnell woman's outstretched hands. A large foot track printed in blood had been stamped across the word Vader. Still calm in the chaos, Carter glanced around and saw that Rennie was staring at the shambles of his audience, his face shocked and unbelieving. Good. Carter yanked out the tails of his shirt. A screaming woman, it was Carla Venziano, ran into him, and he hurled her aside. Then he jammed the Vader envelope into his belt at the small of his back and bloused the tails of his shirt out over it. A little insurance was always a good thing. He backed toward the stage, not wanting to be blindsided. When he reached the stairs, he turned and trotted up them. Randolph, the town's fearless chief, was still in his seat with his hands planted on his meaty thighs. He could have been a statue, except for the single vein pulsing in the center of his forehead. Carter took Big Jim by the arm. Come on, boss. Big Jim looked at him as if he did not quite know where or even who he was. Then his eyes cleared a little.
Grinnell?
Carter pointed to the body of the woman sprawled in the center aisle, the growing puddle around her head matching her dress.
Okay, good, Big Jim said. Let's get out of here. Downstairs. You too, Peter. Get up.
And when Randolph continued to sit and stare at the maddened crowd, Big Jim kicked him in the shin.
Move!
In the pandemonium, no one heard the shots from next door. 25.
Barbie and Rusty stared at each other.
What the hell is going on over there? Rusty asked.
I don't know, Barbie said, but it doesn't sound good. There were more gunshots from the town hall, then one that was much closer. From upstairs. Barbie hoped it was their guys. And then he heard someone yell.
No, Junior! What are you, crazy? Wardlaw, back me up!
More gunshots followed. Four, maybe five.
Oh, Jesus, Rusty said. We're in trouble.
I know, Barbie said. 26. Junior paused on the PD steps, looking over his shoulder toward the newly hatched uproar at the town hall. The people on the benches outside were now standing and craning their necks, but there was nothing to see. Not for them and not for him. Perhaps someone had assassinated his father. He could hope. It would save him the trouble. But in the meantime, his business was inside the PD. In the coop, to be specific. Junior pushed through the door with, "Working together, your hometown police department and you," printed on it. Stacy Moggin came hurrying toward him. Rupe Libby was behind her. In the ready room, standing in front of the grumpy sign reading, "Coffee and donuts are not free," was Mickey Wardlaw. Hulk or not, he looked very frightened and unsure of himself.
You can't come in here, Junior, Stacy said.
Sure I can.
Sure came out sure. It was the numbness at the side of his mouth.
Thallium poisoning. Barbie.
I'm on force.
You're drunk is what you are. What's going on over there?
But then, perhaps deciding he was incapable of any coherent reply, the bitch gave him a push in the center of his chest. It made him stagger on his bad leg and almost fall.
Go away, Junior.
She looked back over her shoulder and spoke her last words on Earth.
You stay where you are, Wardlaw. No one goes downstairs.
When she turned back, meaning to bulldoze Junior out of the station ahead of her, she found herself looking into the muzzle of a police-issue Beretta. There was time for one more thought. Oh, no, he wouldn't. And then a painless boxing glove hit her between the breasts and drove her backward. She saw Rupe Libby's amazed face upside down as her head tilted back. Then she was gone.
No, Junior, what are you, crazy? Rupe shouted, clawing for his gun. Wardlaw, back me up!
But Mickey Wardlaw only stood gaping as Junior pumped five bullets into Piper Libby's cousin. His left hand was numb, but his right was still okay. He didn't even need to be a particularly good shot, with a stationary target just 7 feet away. The first two rounds went into Rupe's belly, driving him against Stacy Moggin's desk and knocking it over. Rupe doubled up, holding himself. Junior's third shot went wild, but the next two went into the top of Rupe's head. He went down in a grotesquely balletic posture, his legs splaying out to either side and his head, what remained of it, coming to rest on the floor, as if in a final, deep bow. Junior limped into the ready room with the smoking Beretta held out in front of him. He couldn't remember exactly how many shots he had fired. He thought 7, maybe 8, or 11-9. Who could know for sure? His headache was back. Mickey Wardlaw raised his hand. There was a frightened, placatory smile on his large face.
No trouble for me, bro, he said. You do what you gotta do, and made the peace sign.
I will, Junior said. Bro.
He shot Mickey. The big boy went down, peace sign now framing the hole in his head that had lately held an eye. The remaining eye rolled up to look at Junior with the dumb humility of a sheep in the shearing pen. Junior shot him again, just to be sure. Then he looked around. He had the place to himself, it appeared.
Okay, he said. Okay.
He started toward the stairs, then went back to Stacy Moggin's body. He verified the fact that she was carrying a Beretta Taurus like his and ejected the mag from his own gun. He replaced it with a full one from her belt. Junior turned, staggered, went to one knee, and got up again. The black spot on the left side of his vision now seemed as big as a manhole cover, and he had an idea that meant his left eye was pretty much fucked. Well, that was all right. If he needed more than one eye to shoot a man locked in a cell, he wasn't worth a hoot in a henhouse anyway. He walked across the ready room, slipped in the late Mickey Wardlaw's blood, and almost fell again. But he caught himself in time. His head was thumping, but he welcomed it. It's keeping me sharp, he thought.
Hello, Barbie, he called down the stairs. I know what you did to me, and I'm coming for you. If you've got a prayer to say, better make it a quick one.
27. Rusty watched the limping legs descend the metal stairs. He could smell gun smoke, he could smell blood, and he understood perfectly well that his time of dying had come around. The limping man was here for Barbie, but he would almost certainly not neglect a certain caged physician's assistant on his way by. He was never going to see Linda or the Jays again. Junior's chest came into view, then his neck, then his head. Rusty took one look at the mouth, which was dragged down on the left in a frozen leer, and at the left eye, which was weeping blood, and thought, very far gone. A wonder he's still on his feet, and a pity he didn't wait just a little longer and he wouldn't have been capable of crossing the street. Faintly, in another world, he heard a bullhorn amplified voice from the town hall. Do not run. Do not panic. The danger is over. This is Officer Henry Morrison, and I repeat, the danger is over.
Junior slipped, but by then he was on the last stair. Instead of falling and breaking his neck, he only went to one knee. He rested that way for a few moments, looking like a prize fighter waiting for the mandatory 8 count to rise and resume the bout. To Rusty, everything seemed clear, near, and very dear. The precious world, suddenly grown thin and insubstantial, was now only a single gauze wrapping between him and whatever came next. If anything. Go all the way down, he thought at Junior. Fall on your face. Pass out, you motherfucker. But Junior laboriously rose to his feet, gazed at the gun in his hand as if he had never seen such a thing before, then looked down the corridor to the cell at the end, where Barbie stood with his hands wrapped around the bars, looking back.
Barbie,
Junior said in a crooning whisper, and started forward. Rusty stepped backward, thinking that perhaps Junior would miss him on his way by, and perhaps kill himself after finishing with Barbie. He knew these were craven thoughts, but he also knew they were practical thoughts. He could do nothing for Barbie, but he might be able to survive himself. And it could have worked, had he been in one of the cells on the left side of the corridor, because that was Junior's blind side. But he had been put in one on the right, and Junior saw him move. He stopped and peered in at Rusty, his half-frozen face simultaneously bewildered and sly.
Fusty, he said. Is that your name? Or is it Barrick? I can't remember.
Rusty wanted to beg for his life, but his tongue was pasted to the roof of his mouth. And what good would begging do? The young man was already raising the gun. Junior was going to kill him. No power on earth would stop him. Rusty's mind, in its last extremity, sought an escape many other minds had found in their last moments of consciousness. Before the switch was pulled, before the trap opened, before the pistol pressed against the temple spat fire. This is a dream, he thought, all of it. The dome, the craziness in Dinsmore's field, the food riot, this young man, too. When he pulls the trigger, the dream will end, and I'll wake up in my own bed, on a cool and crisp fall morning. I'll turn to Linda and say, what a nightmare I had. You won't believe it.
Close your eyes, Fusty, Junior said. It'll be better that way.
28. Jackie Weddington's first thought upon entering the PD lobby was, oh my dear God, there's blood everywhere. Stacy Moggin lay against the wall below the community outreach bulletin board with her cloud of blonde hair spread around her and her empty eyes staring up at the ceiling. Another cop, she couldn't make out which one, was sprawled on his face in front of the overturned reception desk, his legs spread out to either side at an impossibly deep split. Beyond him, in the ready room, a third cop lay dead on his side. That one had to be Wardlaw, one of the new kids on the block. He was too big to be anyone else. The sign over the coffee station table was spattered with the kids' blood and brains. It now read, K, Fee, and Do, R, Ot, Free. There was a faint clacking sound from behind her.
She whirled, unaware that she had raised her gun until she saw Romy Burpee in the front sight. Romy didn't even notice her. He was staring at the bodies of the three dead cops. The clack had been his Dick Cheney mask. He had taken it off and dropped it on the floor.
"Christ,"